My name's Miguel. I'm an alcoholic. I got sober December 18th in 1996, and it's not my fault I've been sober since then. I have a sponsor. His name is Willard Machen. He's been sober since September of 1965. He wouldn't mind telling you that, He's a very good man. Just a few things. When I got sober, I was told to have a home group, so I go to 1313 as much as I can, and I try to make it every Friday, so I'm accountable at that meeting, because I don't know how to do sobriety any other way. I started drinking when I was 13 years old, kind of by accident, I guess. My mom was a diplomat. She's not retired, and she was a diplomat for a foreign country. So once a year here in the States, she would get to buy liquor tax-free for the whole year for different events. So she went off to a party. Me and my friends raided her stash and got pretty trashed. And I remember that night I ate cold pizza, like frozen. I remember I threw up. I remember I blacked out. Well, I blacked out for a couple of hours. And then I came to on like a, I think a bed sheet. And that's all I was wearing. And I remember thinking to myself, that was pretty badass. Like, I had a great time. And that's not normal. And as I started kind of growing up, I was, I guess, blessed or doomed with people trying to always help me. I'm the kind of guy that people want to help all the time, right? Like, they go out of their way to make sure that stuff doesn't happen to me that's bad. And what that looked like is I never had any consequences drinking, especially early on. Especially I went to high school in Corpus Christi, and I dated most of the judge's daughters, so nothing ever happened to me. You know, and me and my friends would always throw parties on the weekends. We would, for being in high school, we were pretty organized. We would get a band, hire some off-duty cops, rent one of our friends' houses, make flyers, go to the other high schools, hand them out, and throw parties on a Friday night for cover charges, and then with the profits, we party balls on Saturday. That's just what we would do. And if the parties got raided, we had cops there anyway, so it wasn't really that big of a deal. So by the time I was a junior in high school, I was drinking pretty much every day. And I was playing soccer every day. I used to play soccer year-round on a traveling team. And I remember my junior year in high school, my mom was transferred out of the U.S. And I went with her to Canada for the summer, and that didn't work out too good for me. And I wound up going back to Corpus Christi. And I wound up living with an Episcopalian priest and his family. His son played soccer, and his son had just moved there from San Antonio, and we were on the same traveling team. And much to my surprise, they were pretty liberal for being, like, religious people, right? Like, we had no curfew. We had girls over all the time. I remember one time they left for a family reunion, and they wrote on the TV on a note, please do not party too much and try to clean up the house before we get back. Because they knew I drank. By that time, everybody knew I drank. It wasn't like a big secret. The thing about that, by the time my senior year came up, I was scared. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what life was after that. Because up until that point, it's cool to party if your parents pay for everything, right? But after that, like, what do you do? All of a sudden, I'm looking at being an adult, and I don't know how that looks. So I avoided all kinds of college talk until one day Father Stringer called up the school I was at and said, my son's fixing to graduate, and he's scared to kind of see what's going on with college. Can you have some people talk to him? And I had two schools take an interest in me. One was St. Mary's in San Antonio, and one was Columbia in New York. And they were looking at me for soccer because they needed to rebuild their soccer teams. And I remember when the year came up for school, I started high school as an honor student, right? And the more I drank, the less honors classes I took because I was drinking. So when I was about to graduate high school, I wasn't sure that I was going to graduate. I thought I was going to fail and have to go to summer school because at that point I was going to the beach every day, drinking every day. I was skipping classes because I needed a drink. Right? It wasn't because I was trying to be cool or anything. At that point, I was a daily drinker. And by some miracle, I graduated high school. I really don't know how that happened because I wasn't going to classes. I wasn't getting any grades. I think I got like a C in a couple of classes that semester. Man, looking back on it, I have no idea how I passed. How I graduate, I just don't. What I do remember from that is that everybody had these high expectations of me. Because I'm the kind of guy that, like I said, everybody wants to help. I'm the guy with potential. Everyone talks about the person. You know, you got so much potential. If you just, don't drink and buckle down and do blah, You have so much potential if you just do this. You have so much potential. Don't you think about your family? Everyone wants to help me. They tell me how much of a child of promise I am, right? But they all end it with, but if you don't drink, which that's not a normal sentence if you're an 18-year-old in high school. That just isn't. I remember my senior year, and I'll kind of move on after this. They gave us an anonymous test in high school, and it was for drug and alcohol addiction week, I think, or some shit like that. And I remember I was late to class because I was hungover, and they said it was a Scantron anonymous test. They just wanted to kind of pull the high school, see how bad the problem was in our high school. And I remember cheating on that test. Like, I fudged the numbers, right? Like, it said, how often do you drink? And I said, maybe once a week or once every other weekend. How many do you drink? And I thought about that. A couple could be two or could be 10. That's kind of subjective. So I put down two and just stuff like that. And I thought to myself, afterwards, I thought to myself, people that are normal don't lie on anonymous drug and alcohol tests. They just don't. That doesn't come to their mind, right? They're just honest, you know? I got to St. Mary's University with the intention of graduating with a degree in electrical engineering and playing soccer. That was the intention. So I remember, if you ever play sports in college, and there's sports for the most part year-round, you get there about a month prior to school opening, and you do two-a-days, right? So I get to St. Mary's, and we do two-a-days. And what that looks like is from 8 o'clock to noon, you pretty much just do wind sprints, stomach crunches, push-ups. Then you break for lunch. And then in the afternoon, from 1 to 4, you do soccer drills, and you do scrimmages, and you run some more, right? Here's the problem. By the time I got to San Antonio, as my friend says, water finds its own level. I found the drunks that were there early, right? So we go drinking, and then every day I'm getting back to the dorms at 6 in the morning, still drunk, having to show up to the field at 7:30 to stretch to start running wind sprints at 8 in the morning. Now, understand what that looks like. You detox while you're running wind sprints. And they had these buckets of water, ammonia, ice, and towels that they would throw on your face if you passed out. Because when you do wind sprints in college, you do, if I remember correctly, it was 25-yard sprints, 20, 10 yards, 20, 20, 20, 25, 20, 30, all the way until you get to the 150-yard mark. And they have like a parachute kind of pulling you behind. So it's not exactly the best place to be doing detox. And the South Texas heat, right? It just isn't. So I quit going to practice. I just couldn't, I couldn't juggle both. I couldn't drink and go to practice. And I remember one day, this guy showed up to my dorm room and knocked on the door. And I used to always say that I was kicked off the soccer team. That's why I quit playing soccer. But really happened is I quit showing up. And that guy said, "Hey, man, coach wants to know if you're ever coming back." I said, "I don't know. Maybe." And that kind of ended my soccer career because drinking took priority. It just did. By the end of the first semester, they had, if you've ever been to college and it's been out of where you live, they have this, like, in every college, every university has this. They have this one class, it's like an orientation class, to teach students how to migrate from being living at home forever to now being single and kind of by themselves with no supervision. And they give you all kinds of skill sets, right? They had a drug and alcohol day class went through that semester. And this person gave a presentation on drugs and alcohol and addiction. And my gut inherently said, "I need to talk to this person." So I went and talked to them after their spiel for that class. And he took me back to his office at St. Mary's University. And he gave me this 40-question test that I scored extremely high on, by the way. That's the only test I ever scored high on at St. Mary's, by the way. but that's neither here nor there. He said, "Based on what you just told me, you're an alcoholic, man." He says, "Do you, in the mornings when you wake up, have no more hangovers?" I was at the time 19. I said, "Yeah." He goes, "You just put water on your face, you're good to go." I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Do you drink with different people every night?" I said, "Yeah." Because not everybody drinks every night, so you got to drink with different groups every night. He says, "Do you drink with people you hang out with?" I said, "Yeah." And on and on and on and on. He said, "You know, man, you're an alcoholic, and it's going to get worse. Not better." But he did say this where I think he kind of fucked up. He told me, "Do not go to AA because you're not going to relate to all these old-timers that are low-bottom drunks." He sent me to a place that was kind of like AA, but it wasn't, with a bunch of young people. And I remember pulling up to the church in San Antonio, putting my car in park, and I thought to myself, there's no way in hell I'm quitting drinking. I'm 19 years old. This is a phase I'm going through. Everyone who's 19 drinks like this. I didn't realize most of my friends were going to class, were getting, you know, good grades, were progressing their career path at St. Mary's. I was not doing any of that. When I set foot on that campus, the farthest thing from my mind was graduation. I was going to college to play soccer and drink. That was kind of my vision of going to college. So I left that place without setting foot in there. And by the end of that year, I was asked to leave St. Mary's University. I think I had 30 attempted hours, and it had a 0.21 GPA. And I was on their list of drunks and drug addicts because it's a small school, 2,000 people, so if you're loud, obnoxious, arrogant drunk who blacks out and does stupid shit, they just know who you are. All right, so I didn't know what to do about that. You know, I wound up leaving St. Mary's and going to Canada for, I think I was in Canada for a good year with my mom, because that was always my fix, right? Go somewhere where someone could take care of me, I could take a vacation from reality, and I'll get my shit together. That didn't quite happen either, because in Canada, I found my people too, man. I found the people that drink and use drugs and all that kind of jazz, right? So it wasn't much of a difference. By the time I got back to Texas, it was in 1996, early on, and my drinking buddy, Gerard, who I went to high school with, but we're on the same traveling team, he had to move to San Antonio. So he convinced me to go to San Antonio. And by that time, man, I went from having a plethora of friends, because I'm the life of the party if I'm sober, right, to having what I say, no friends, pretty much. My mom and my attorney were like my best friends. And that's because he paid for the attorney, or else we wouldn't be talking much. It's funny, you know, if you drink long enough, your world gets smaller. Funny thing, too, in sobriety, if you don't work the steps and you get miserable, your world gets smaller. I thought it was a good judgment of if you're spiritually fit or not in sobriety, is how big is your world, you know? I'll get to that later, though. So anyways, I started drinking a lot more in San Antonio because I had no friends. Had a little small efficiency apartment that was probably that size squared. It had two mattresses on the floor, upside-down laundry basket that was my entertainment center, and a TV-VCR combo. And I thought I was living large, right? And I was almost getting evicted every month from that place, too, which is kind of odd. I was bartending at that time because I figured if I bartended, I wouldn't drink as much, which is not really the case. I drank a lot more. I got fired from almost every bartending job I had because they thought I was stealing, but really I wasn't stealing. I just got so drunk I couldn't Z out at night properly, and I couldn't make all my totals, and I'd forget to ring up stuff. And it was just, you know, if you drink like I drink, that stuff kind of happens. So I'll never forget, man, I called the day before I got sober. I think it's somewhere in those first three days. I was hanging out. I was dating a girl who was a entertainer, and her roommate was a nurse's assistant, and she was dating my buddy Gerard, and we were at her place, and it was her birthday, and because it was her birthday, all the girls that worked with her gave her booze, right? So we're at this bar. First off, she asked me to be her designated driver. I remember Leslie saying, "Please do me a favor, don't drink tonight. It's my birthday. I want to get trashed. You're the one that always gets trashed. I got to take care of you." She gave me her keys and said, "Please don't drink. Just, you know, be our driver tonight." And I said, "Sure." So I come to that night, right? Because they closed the bar, and Leslie is looking for her designated driver. And all the people at the bar knew us. So they said, "Leslie, he is passed out in your Bronco with the keys in the ignition in the front seat. So I don't think he's driving you." So somewhere in that process, I start to sober up a bit, and we get back over to Leslie's place. And if you ever like drink and then sober up, you got to keep on drinking. There's no like stopping it and just kind of going to bed, right? So I look at Leslie and I said, "Leslie, I'm not done drinking." And like I said, most of the girls she worked with gave her like bottles of of booze and stuff for her birthday. So she looked at me and she said, there was this box, I'll never forget it. It was a pink box with a Jack Daniels bottle and two Jack Daniels, like, special edition glasses. She said, Miguel, she goes, I want to drink this. I'm going to hide this from you. She goes, but everything else in the house, you can go ahead and drink. So me and my buddy Gerard did that. We got smoked a little pot and did that. Drugs are not pretty much part of my story. I smoked pot a couple of times when I was drunk because I had to. Like the first time I smoked pot, I was living in a Motel 6 with a couple of friends. And one of my buddies owed a drug dealer some money, so he partied with us for a while. And the only way he was comfortable with me is if I would smoke pot. So I remember like being almost passed out in the bed and him shoving a joint in my mouth and making me smoke it. And he's like, okay, you're cool. They did the same thing a couple of more times. And then we did try to sell pot once. We stole a drug dealer's plants in Flower Bluff, Texas. And we put them out to dry in the bathroom at the Motel 6. But I forgot the potheads smoke pot, right? So those guys smoked all the plants. I think we sold one bag. And that was kind of like my big drug deal, like, you know, gone wrong in sobriety. So back to that night. I drank, I black out, I pass out. And when I woke up, my buddy Gerard had this look of horror on his face. I don't know how else to put it. He looked really concerned. I was on the floor. I was laying face down because drunks know how to take care of drunks. Gerard put me on the floor, and he put my face to the side so I wouldn't choke on my own blood. And what he said was, he said, Papa, you puked up too much blood last night. He goes, I tried to clean up most of it, but there was just way, way too much. And what nobody knew by that point, I was shaking in the mornings. I was puking up blood. My skin was pale. My eyes were yellow. And I needed a drink. I wasn't drinking to be social anymore. I wasn't drinking to be the life of the party. I would shake if I didn't drink, right? I didn't go to treatment, so I got sober, my efficiency, basically. So what that looks like is I, like, shook for 6 months, right? And then, man, I would drench my sheets in sweat just from all the deep. I mean, it was bad. Anyways, so Gerard looked horrified because he had never seen that happen before. No one had. And he said, you got to lay off the sauce, man. You just got to lay off the sauce. And I said, I know, dude. I've tried, but I can't. He said, well, look. He goes, let me. So what he did was he stole money from his girlfriend's purse, and then he took us all out to breakfast on him. And he said, let's not drink today. By lunch, him and I were at this bar drinking wine. Because at that time, he was a bartender, too, and we were trying to be wine connoisseurs. So I think we must have, like, chugged down, like, 4 bottles of wine. Because each bottle has, like, 4 glasses, right? Which isn't, if you drink it, that's not mean that much wine. I mean, that much booze. And I remember thinking to myself, we're not supposed to be drinking. Or at least I'm not. Right? I told myself I'm not going to drink today. And I didn't know what to do. Gerard's dad is, to this day, a drug and alcohol counselor. When he 12-stepped me, he had 8 years sober. He went back out at 13 years. I think he got sober again just a few years ago. And I'll tell you, and that's important for a reason. So that night, Gerard calls me to go drinking, and I'm scared. I said, Gerard, I don't know what to do, man. I don't think I should be drinking. I don't know, man. I got no friends. I can't make a living. I'm dying physically. I don't know what to do. He goes, look, man, you live right around the corner from Whiskey Smith's. He goes, they got 75 shots. He goes, let's go to Whiskey Smith's, get a couple of shots in us, and talk about what to do about your drinking problem. So that's what we did. We went to Whiskey Smith's for a few shots of whiskey to discuss my peril. And he said, he goes, talk to my dad, man. Because my dad's always telling us, if you want an assessment, go talk to him. So the next day, I talked to his dad. I said, Roy, I can't quit drinking, man. I'm puking the blood in the mornings. I'm shaking. And he goes, well, get in my car. He goes, put the Heineken down and get in my car, because I used to drink Heineken in the mornings. There was a gas station down the street from where Gerard lived, and I stayed there a whole lot, that sold dollar Heineken. And if you're broke or on a budget, that's a pretty decent beer to get in the mornings, right? So we took Gerard to work, and then Roy was his name. Roy interpreted me telling him that I was puking up blood and couldn't quit drinking until I want to get sober. That's not what I said, though. But that's what he interpreted. And he called me to go into an AA meeting. According to him, we went to a bunch of meetings. I don't remember any of those. The first one I remember was Club 12 in San Antonio, Texas. And because it was during the holidays, I got sober. I picked the 18th of December because I remember being sober that day. It was probably somewhere before then, but May 18th works for me. So that's a week prior to Christmas and 2 weeks prior to New Year's Eve. Right? So we get there, and as you know, if you've been sober a while, you get the influx of newcomers during the holidays for whatever reason, right? That just happens. Not much of them stay, but a lot of them come. And I remember we were late to this meeting, and this guy starts talking, and I'm thinking to myself, where are we? He's an old guy. He's dressed in a suit. You can tell he's got money. He's crying. He's talking to the group, and I'm thinking, who does that? Like, what kind of man cries in public, right? He was like a few weeks sober and scared shitless that he's going to drink, but I didn't understand that. I'm still kind of trying to figure out where I'm at. So he shuts up, and someone else starts to talk, and they go, my name is so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic. And I thought to myself, whoa, I've never been to AA, but this sounds like AA. You know, that I don't know, something here that isn't jiving, because I don't belong here. I come from an affluent family, I'm a nice guy, people like me. I do not belong in this group of people. Meanwhile, I hadn't showered in God knows how long. I had a pair of jeans that hadn't been washed in God knows how long that reeked because it had vomit and whiskey and all kinds of mix from the bar, you know. My shoes were disgusting because they're the shoes I wore when I was bartending and when I was out and about. You know, my skin's pale, but I'm judging all these people, right? Like, I don't belong here. I'm much way better than they are. Luckily, alcohol gave me nowhere else to go, quite honestly. So we went to this other meeting that, you know, the next day. Roy said, what do you want to do, man? Because he kept me at his place for, like, I think 4 or 5 days to make sure that I didn't, you know, that if I detoxed too hard, if I needed to go to a hospital, he would take me there, right? Because you can die from coming off of booze. Drugs, you feel like it, but booze, it could actually kill you. So he kind of let me stay at his house for a few days. And for some reason, I told him I want to go back to this other meeting that we went to. And it was the Winners Club in San Antonio. And I asked this guy to sponsor me, you know, he told my stories what happened. And I'm not a big fan of meetings that don't want to talk about drunkalogs because when you get sober, you have nothing to relate to, right? You cannot relate to sobriety unless you've been sober. Luckily, that gentleman talked about his drinking and his sobriety. And what caught my attention is he said, obviously, he was puking up blood in the mornings and all that kind of stuff when he was drinking. But he talked about getting sober and in early sobriety going to HEB and having to buy toothpaste, toilet paper, shampoo, and soap. Because he was a Skid Row bum that got sober, and then he found a little place to live, and he didn't have any of that. And I thought to myself, man, I have to go buy toothpaste, toilet paper, shampoo, and soap, because if you drink like I drink, you don't buy those things. You buy booze. That's just the way it is, right? At least that's my experience. You know, I make a lot of concessions to alcohol when it comes to my life, and I don't even realize it. You know, I think the book says I'm delusional. It says my alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. Because I was raised better than that, right? It's just, that's what you do when you drink. So as I get sober, man, I was so fortunate. I was 23 years old, and it seemed like all the old-timers at these meetings, because I was there to get sober, I wasn't there to get laid, I wasn't there to be popular, I was there to get sober. All these old-timers took a vested interest in my life, and then went out of their way to be nice to me. We have traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And one of them that never applied to me prior to AA, but applied to me after I got sober is the 11th tradition. I became attracted to Alcoholics Anonymous after I got sober because people were just kind. You know, I remember I was 2 weeks sober, and this is kind of a funny story. I was 2 weeks sober, and I was burning up in fever, and I went to the Winners Club in soccer shorts, sandals, and a T-shirt. And my sponsor, he went to the meeting. I was at. He goes, What's your plan for the day, Mikey? And I said, nothing. He goes, come on, you're coming with me. And we go to this guy's ranch in AA, and they were going dove hunting, I think. And I had never been hunting in my life. So my idea of hunting, as I always say, is Looney Tunes, Elmer Fudd, you know, with the rifle like this kind of shooting in front of stuff, right? So the AA takes me over to the ranch, and I meet Don Pope. And he said, and the other thing, too, is every sponsor I've had has never belittled me. They've never said I'm their pigeon, I'm their sponsee. They've always said I'm their friend. You know, and in this case, Danny said, this is my friend Mikey, he's new. And Don looks at me and he says, man, you ever fired a shotgun before? I said, no. So he looks at me for a second and he starts to think about it and he goes away and he comes back with some, like, clothes for hunting, some Advil for my fever, and some shotgun shells and a shotgun. And he says, don't shoot my dog, my truck. And if you load the rifle, make sure it's facing in the air and the safety's on and you're not pointing it at anybody. Now, I had never hunted before. Remember, I said that. So I grazed his dog. I grazed his truck. And then when I loaded the rifle, it was pointing right at Don. And the safety was off. He's like, wait a minute. He goes, hold on, we go. So after he loaded the rifle for me, they all talked amongst themselves. And they said, Mikey, go way out there. We'll flush the dove out when they're overhead. That's when you could shoot. And that's what they did, you know. And the fever broke somewhere in between that little hunting experience. And at the end of the day, we had backstrap at Don's place. And the next year, he invited me again to go dove hunting at his ranch. I didn't go because I didn't see. I was, you know, I'm kind of impatient. I don't see the point of hunting and fishing. I want, like, stuff now. And I'm just too impatient, right? I guess it's meditative. I don't know. But here's the thing. All of those guys that were worried about me killing him that day, legitimately, talked about the steps to me. They asked me why I was in AA. They told me some of their story. They told me how they had done the steps, about this God they had found. And they gave me hope. Because I don't know about anybody else, but when I came into AA, I really needed some hope. I needed to know that it was going to get better somehow. That I wasn't just a piece of shit. That I wasn't always going to be an alcoholic who couldn't get his act together no matter how hard he tried, no matter how many times he moved, no matter how many promises he gave his family that were well-intentioned, right? Whenever I promised stuff drinking, I never promised without wanting to follow through. I just never could. So as I get sober, my mom was in Canada at the time. She was posted at her embassy up in Canada, as I said before, and she came down to visit for Christmas. So I had about 7 days sober. And I remember she met my first sponsor, Danny, and she said, what can I do for my son? He's my only son. I want to help him. How can I help him stay sober? And he looked at her and he said, you're only his mother. You can't do anything for him. And she got pissed. Like a good Al-Anon, right? She wanted to be like, I can help him. And then he looks at me and he looks at her. And I had just asked her to be my sponsor like 2 days before. And then he pissed me off. He looked at me, he looked at her, and he said, if you really want to help him, take away his credit cards. And I was like, holy shit, that's kind of drastic, man. I need money. We're going to take away his credit cards. And she did, which, you know, looking back on it, that's probably the best thing she could have done. The other thing, too, is my mom, in her lack of understanding about alcoholism, thought if she gave me the best possible circumstances, it would facilitate me getting sober. Right? So she wanted to take me back to Canada, keep me there for a year, put me in some treatment center. And in my heart, I knew if I did that, it'd be a vacation. I knew it would be a vacation in Canada because I would have no consequences. And I told her, Mom, I'm staying in San Antonio. And that first year was hard, man. I didn't have a car. You know, I still lived in that same efficiency because I didn't make much money. I didn't have any skill sets. I owed money to everybody and their mother. I had warrants for my arrest I had to pay off eventually. It was not an easy year by any means. But the cool thing was, man, that my only priority was staying sober. Whatever job I had, which actually was bartending, I worked around my meeting schedule. I was focused on going to meetings, working the steps, working the traditions, and getting sober. My first sponsor told me, Mike, you don't call me unless you have a question on the steps, the traditions, or something you heard at an AA meeting until you do 4 through 9. Because until then, your perspective is fucked, and I don't want to hear it, he told me. Until you work the steps, it's their fault. Everyone's against you. Life's unfair. I'm getting the short end of the stick. He goes, and I got time for that. He goes, I'm 27 years. He goes, I'm 32 years old. I got a life. I go to the gym. I get laid every once in a while. I go to work. He goes, I ain't got time to hear you kind of complain. He also told me that he wouldn't sponsor me unless I had a home group where they made their own coffee, that I went to that group every week, that I got a service commitment at that meeting, and that I read what he asked me to read. Because Danny understood that the big book is life-saving, right? That his message wasn't unique. Matter of fact, when I asked him to be my sponsor, he asked me, he said, do you want a drink today? I said, yeah, I do. Really bad. He goes, I know, man, I know. This is why. And we sat down and we read the doctor's opinion. And the doctor's opinion, man, that's one of my favorite chapters because That's how I knew I belonged in AA. It described me to a T when I drank. And up until that point, no one knew why I drank. I mean, they had their best guesses. You know, I'm spoiled, I'm entitled, or I had an absent father, or my dad's an asshole, or whatever the case is, right? But up until a doctor's opinion, no one actually understood alcoholism. That nailed me. Till this day, man, that chapter is a powerful chapter. Anyways, I started working the steps with Danny, and I'll never forget, I was about 9 months sober, and I fought the steps. I didn't fight the steps because I was agnostic or atheist. I fought the steps because I grew up devout Catholic, and when I looked at the steps, I saw my sacraments in the steps, right? I saw 4 and 5 is confession, 6 and 7 is act of contrition, and 8 and 9 is penance. So I'm thinking, I've done this shit. Why do I got to do it again? Right? Matter of fact, I went to minor seminary. I was going to be a priest at one time to fix my alcoholism, but it didn't work out too good. But so I fought the steps for a while, and a buddy of mine fought the steps with me too. He got sober 3 months after I did, and he was going crazy like I was sober. Because here's the thing, man. People forget that drinking treats alcoholism, but it kills you. Right? And if you're not drinking and not working the steps, untreated alcoholism will drive you crazy. That's been my experience. Anyways, this guy, he blew his brains out at 6 months sober. Cause he believed step one. He believed he was an alcoholic, right? He believed physical allergy, mental obsession. He was powerless. He couldn't do anything about it. But he would not work the steps. And his solution to that was to blow his brains out. So that night, I went home. I did a 4-step. And I called my sponsor at like 3 in the morning. He's like, Mikey, I'm asleep. I said, I just finished my 4-step. He goes, good. He goes, I can't meet you tomorrow, but I can meet you in the day or the very next day. And if we do the 4-step out of the big book, it should be the first time you feel like shit because you see your part in everything, right? It's not one of those happy, dory kind of feelings. You see, where have I been selfish, self-centered, self-seeking? Where have I been frightened? Where have I caused all this damage in my life? And it's kind of a big old chunk of yourself to take in, right? So I waited, and Danny took me to San Pedro Park in San Antonio because Danny was also a drug addict and alcoholic, and he started using and drinking at San Pedro Park. So he wanted kind of to share some of his life with me. And we sat at that park on a Sunday morning, and he was very literal about the big book. The big book doesn't say I read you my 4-step. It says I tell you my life story. That's what it says. There's no argument about that. So I sat there, and I told that man my life story. And in doing so, my 4-step came out, because I mean, it has to. I bared my soul to this man for about 4 or 5 hours, give or take. I'm pretty sure at some point he probably fell asleep because he had sunglasses on and he kind of dozed off a little bit. But he was listening because after I finished my 4-step, we left San Pedro Park and I felt like I had this weight lifted off me. I know how to explain it. And we got in this car and he says, Mikey, the story you just told me is a classic alcoholic story. He goes, you drink as much as you do. That's just what we do. He goes, you never have to do any of that stuff again. He goes, you probably will, but you don't have to. He also said, from this point on, you can no longer blame your actions on your alcoholism. You don't drink anymore, Mikey. It doesn't fly anymore to say, I can't keep a job because I'm alcoholic. I can't do this because I'm alcoholic. That's no longer an excuse. You have to take responsibility. And then he said, man, you have a lot of areas where you have to grow up because you're young. And my experience with sobriety and getting sober young, like most young people, is that I had a lot of fear. Not so much resentment, but I had a lot of fear in having to deal with life, right? Because I didn't have any experience with that stuff. If you get sober older, just by living, you do shit. You get a job, you get married, you might get divorced, you might have kids. You get sober young, you don't have those experiences, man. And as you're building some faith, that could become a daunting task. So he told me, man, in these areas of your life, God will put probably old-timers in your path that'll help you with those things. Because he understood that he was not the end-all be-all for AA. He made sure I understood that. He said, the group will help you get sober, Mikey. That's why you have to have a home group. Because I walk you the steps, but the group itself, your home group, they'll help you get sober. He was by far the farthest thing from a guru you'd want, which is what you probably want of a sponsor, by the way. He knew his strengths and limitations. Thank God for that, man. Because what that man did is he made me God-dependent, not sponsor-dependent. You know, and I moved to Denver 3 years sober for school. I moved to Ohio at 5 years sober because I fell in love. Then that didn't work out, right? So a few months later, I moved back to San Antonio. And Danny wasn't with me in all those places. But he let me find a God, and he gave me a foundation. So wherever I went, I was able to be part of AA. You know, my sponsor Danny's big on service work. But he also says, if you're going to do service work, don't bitch about it and don't brag about it. He says, that's between you and God. Or else it doesn't count. What I will say is that I've done everything from make coffee to I've served on different young people conference committees. Like when I was in Denver, we hosted the Western Area Conference of Young People in AA, and I was a chair in that. San Antonio, we hosted the International Conference of Young People in AA, hosted that. Me and my buddy had the majority of the volunteers for the World Convention back in 2010. I've been GSR, Treasurer. I mean, if you have to like a resume of service work, mine'll stack up against anybody's. But I do that because I want to stay sober. I don't do it because I want to be popular. I don't do it because I'm trying to impress people. I know if I do those things, God gives me more sobriety, right? So somewhere around 15 years sober, my mom is all like heartbroken. You have to understand, it took my mom 3 years to believe that I was serious about staying sober. Because I had always said I'm going to move here and get sober, and it would never happen, right? And she's the one that got the phone calls from the doctors, from the lawyers, from the creditors, from whatever. So just because I got sober for 30 days, they didn't impress her much. You know, because that's just the way, you know, it takes a while to be sober. That's how that works. There's no accelerating that process. All of a sudden, I wanted to have rights, and I wanted her to trust me at 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, and it just doesn't work that way. So it took her 5 years, because she was still in Canada, not to jump every time the phone rang. Like, she would stay at home on the weekends and wait for those phone calls because she was so used to them. I didn't realize how much damage I caused my mom until I got sober. So anyways, 15 years sober. She doesn't know how to tell me that there's bad news in the family. And at the time, I had a sponsor who became like my father. He passed away last year. I miss him dearly, actually. But Sam was not only a member of AA and a professor at UTSA, he was also a therapist. So my mom asked him if he would see her and then have me come along afterwards. So I'm thinking, this got to be kind of serious. If this is, you know, what could it be? Is she got cancer or is something bad in the family? So in his office, he tells me that in the summer of 2009, my uncle, so the family in Mexico had a bunch of money. And if you know what that looks like, they're arrogant, they're entitled, they're classist, they have living maids, chauffeurs. And he got kidnapped. And after the third proof of life and the third payment, he had to sign his mansion over to some lower level cops. He was kidnapped by a police cartel that does kidnappings. So we couldn't do much about that. So my mom was crushed because she didn't know how I'd handle that sober. Can remember, I got 15 years sober, but I'm still her baby boy, right? She still remembers the shakes because she was there when I detoxed. She remembers me sweating like a pig in the night and shaking and you know, painting the efficiency because like, I didn't have any motor skills when I got sober. So she painted my efficiency and covered up the blood. She remembers all that shit. Just because I got 15 years sober doesn't mean it went away. So how does she tell me, right? And she went through a huge depression because it was her baby brother. And so I didn't know what to do, man. I always taught you don't go to meetings to spiel. That's not what they're for, right? But I have a close group of friends that I talk to daily. And we do 10 steps and we talk about stuff. So I asked my buddy John. He's got 6 months more than I do. I go, John, what do I do? He goes, look, dude, have your mom go and pick you up Saturday mornings for breakfast to get her out of the house. She has to go to work during the week, but she cannot be alone in her condo during the weekends because she's going to get depressed. And you just never know with older people, right? So we started this thing of going out to eat every Saturday morning for breakfast. And after a year, I also got her going to Mass with me on Sundays and I would meet her there. I'd make her drive herself to Mass, and we'd meet there and have lunch afterwards. So after Mass on a Sunday, we went and had lunch. And I always hear in meetings people work the steps on stuff. I've never done that. I've worked the steps to stay sober, and God has changed me, right? So what happens is she tells me, she says, she kind of starts crying a little bit. She says, Miguel, you know, this was the toughest year of my life. She goes, I needed someone to lean on. Because I never thought that'd be you. She goes, I needed a son this last year. Not like a little kid son, but like a peer, someone that I could rely on and talk to that was supportive and that would help me. She goes, I've never, ever thought that'd be you. And I'm fucking bawling tears in the parking lot because that's all I ever wanted when I was drinking. I wanted to be a good son. I never could. Right? I went back to school, got my degree late in life. I like what I do for a living. I thought I was doomed to be in the hospitality industry for the rest of my life. That's not the case anymore. You know, I moved to Austin for a job that pays quite well, and that contract ended, so now I'm getting all these offers for other gigs. But at the core of my life, man, AA is still there, right? Like, I go to meetings a lot. I got a sponsor wherever I live. I believe be where you're at. So when I moved here, it worked out that the guy Willard is my sponsor now. He used to sponsor me in San Antonio when I was 7 years sober. So when I moved up here, we just kind of reconnected. I'm a big believer that AA, as long as whatever you put into AA, you get back and more tenfold. Right? Because I'm by far not the poster boy for Alcoholics Anonymous at all. I've probably done everything to tell you not to do. And hey, you know, one of my biggest things is if you go by the book, you have a better chance than if you go by someone's opinion. And what I mean by that is, you will hear in meetings, in the same meeting, you hear some old timer tell you, you got to change everything in your life to get sober. And then you hear some other old timer say, no major changes the first year. Well, who's right? The book says you have a spiritual experience as a result of the steps, and God changes you. That's what the book says. Right? So I tend to err on the book side. You know, if Renewed Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're kind of wondering, do I belong here? Do I want to deal with this God shit? These people are kind of Jesus-y for me. I'll tell you what this old-timer in my home group in San Antonio says. He says, you don't have to believe in God to get sober. Nowhere in the book does it say that, if you actually read it. He says, you probably have to believe in God to stay sober. But if you have not worked all 12 steps, you're in the getting sober phase. So don't worry about it. Just come along for the ride and work the steps. The steps themselves will produce the result. That's why it says at step 12, have you had a spiritual awakening? That's not a step 2 or 3. Don't overcomplicate it. He also always says, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are designed to give you a spiritual experience, whether you want the motherfucker or not, is what he says. That's just what they do. So don't overthink it, man. Come along for the ride. The book's been written. You might be doomed to a good life in spite of yourself like I have. Thank you for hearing me out.